Oh my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh Jesus, please be a plane. Oh please. Are you ready for this?
Man, that, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular hit.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that the days like
this. Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light, struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Harold Bruce Knapp.
Good evening. This is the 403rd edition of Strange Days Indeed. 403rd. And it's good to have you along wherever it is that you're listening to Strange Days Indeed, whether it's in Montreal, here in Toronto, around the world via the World Wide Web, or you're downloading the podcast from iTunes or the MP3 file from virtuallystrange.net. Welcome. Strange Days Indeed. This is the program that observes and reports on the phenomena that surround one of the greatest mysteries that humanity has ever faced. UFOs. Unidentified flying objects. Tonight on the program, Dave Furlott with his take on it, Canadian researcher Grant Cameron, British researcher Andrew Johnson, and taking us home as usual, Alfred Lemberg. Driving News Talk 1010 CFRB in Toronto is Julian McNabb, and Jim Pacheco is doing the same thing at CJAD 800 in Montreal. Some interesting things going on in the field, and before I get to those, I just want to wish a regular contributor to this program, Richard Hall, all the best. He has some unexpected surgery coming up, and our prayers and wishes go out to Richard, and we're pretty darn sure he's going to pull through. He has to. We need him. He's one of the grand old men of ufology, and we need him here for several more years. So fingers, eyes, ears, nose, and toes crossed that the surgeon's scalpel is nice and sharp for Richard. And Wayne St. John will be with us next week, updating the story of Dave, the experiencer, the man who has had some quite remarkable contact with what he describes as humanoid ETs, right here in Toronto, down at the Queen and Leslie area. Story out of Hamner, which is close to Sudbury here in Ontario. Almost every night between 11 and 4 a.m., the witnesses, friend and he, have seen a sphere-like UFO during July. Some nights they see nothing, he says, but they've witnessed these sightings at least twice a week. They started around June 21st. The first object they saw was lit up like a Christmas tree. And that same night, June 21st of this year, they also saw a very weird-looking UFO that was sphere-shaped and hovered very strangely. In the past 5 years, Sudbury and surrounding areas have been a hotspot for sightings, but you ask people living in that city if they've seen anything strange, and you would be amazed at how many have seen them. Someone really needs to investigate Northern Ontario, that witness says, and he had written this to Brian Vike. I guess that if Brian Vike, the director of HBCC UFO Research, was a little more willing to pass his witness reports on to local UFO researchers, Michel Deschamps up there in Sudbury could be looking into this case right now. You listening, Brian? Good. In Rue Saint-Marie, Quebec, a witness was unloading his motorcycle from a trailer on July 12th. and looked up to see three lights forming a large, perfect triangle at about 1,000 feet up. The color was reddish-orange and looked like fire. It was about 10:20 p.m. on July 12th. He said the object moved pretty slowly without a sound. The sky was clear, and he felt that it was, in fact, one big object in a triangular shape. So he ran inside to get his mother and her husband, and when they all came back outside, one of the lights had vanished. The two remaining lights changed direction and kept moving at the same speed, but got closer together until they touched and crossed each other's path and separated again. One light started to dim out, and then the remaining light dimmed and vanished as well. He said it looked like a fire going out. That was in Rue Saint-Marie, Quebec. In Ottawa, here in Ontario, the witness stepped out onto his balcony on July the 8th when he spotted a set of lights at about 50 degrees above the horizon, just coming into view above a rooftop of a 9-story apartment building in Westboro. So he ran for his video recorder and was back on the balcony within about 30 seconds. The object was now further away and still heading west, about a kilometer away. He started recording the tree line and the UFO as it headed north with his night shot mode on his video camera as it flew further away at 9:53 p.m. The UFO only had three lights on it and one pulsated slowly on and off. The object then started heading west in his direction. He kept zooming in, trying to get a clear and steady picture. Said it seemed to be moving along the shoreline, and when it got abreast of him, it was flying low and only a couple of hundred meters away. As it was passing out of sight by the side of his building, he thought the light formation strange. They represented a triangular formation, but however, on viewing the video, an unexpected shape is what he can see. What you can see, if you go to Brian Vike's website, hpccufo.com. And in Gatineau, Quebec, time for one more, July 12th at 10 p.m., the witness was walking upstairs when he saw through a window three orange lights, again, in a triangular formation. So he asked his wife to go out onto the balcony to confirm, and she saw the same thing. He then went and grabbed his camera, and by then one of the lights had disappeared, but he still managed to capture a two-light formation. And on those photos at hpccufo.org, on the pictures, if you go there, you can see two orange lights. The next day, and at the same time, he decided to capture a plane flying in the sky at the same angle and height for comparison. And what he shot the day before were definitely not planes, he says. Thanks to Brian Vike and George Feiler for those items. Coming up next on the program, Dave Ferlott and his take on things. Program 403.
These are strange days indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Ferlott.
There's a thread beginning on the UFO updates list that has me baffled. Actually, it has me more than baffled. It has me amazed and totally shocked. Because if we are to believe what we read as published by the Daily Record, Glasgow, Scotland, on July 24, 2006, well, it would mean that NASA has not been forthcoming about things that their astronauts have discovered in space. Matter of fact, we'd have to go a step forward beyond them not coming forward about things, because NASA has been actively covering things up. Now, wait a second here. How can an agency whose charter is to explore space for the benefit of all mankind be holding information back? Doesn't the exploration of space involve telling us what they find and discover? But no, wait a second. They're not just not telling us about what they have been discovering. They're hiding information from us, and if that information is accidentally discovered, they're denying it. Buzz Aldrin, the second man to walk on the moon, states emphatically that NASA covered up the UFO that he and the other two astronauts observed while on their way to the moon in Apollo 11. Now, according to this article, it's new, but the report by Buzz Aldrin has been known and it's been observed for years. But it's with information that has become recently declassified that this report gets some serious attention. Whoa, wait a second here. Declassified? Now, I have always been under the impression that NASA was not a military agency. Matter of fact, I believe NASA prides itself on being a public agency. When an agency is working on behalf of the public, what possible reason could they have for classifying information? I don't know. It bothers me. But back to Buzz Aldrin's reported UFO sighting for a moment. It seems that he and the other astronauts inquired over the ear about where the Saturn IV booster might be. That was their way of sort of coming out there. Well, now, they did this because they didn't really feel comfortable saying that, well, they were seeing something strange following them on their journey to the moon because they might have been told to turn around and come back home to Earth. Now, the report of Buzz Aldrin's is not the only report of encounters with UFOs in Apollo 11. Apparently, there are other reports that are equally baffling. But Aldrin's report comes straight from his mouth via interviews. Aldrin also mentions that the astronauts kept quiet about everything they saw until they got back to Earth and were debriefed. Okay, again, now I could be wrong here, but I was under the understanding that only military organizations conducted debriefings. And although the Apollo mission astronauts were Air Force and Navy pilots, shouldn't they have conducted a press conference instead of a debriefing? But I digress. According to Aldrin, when they returned to Earth, they were instructed to keep quiet about their UFO encounter because it could jeopardize the space program with public ridicule. Oh, hold on, excuse me. Astronauts are seeing UFOs in space while they're on missions, and NASA is worried about somebody laughing at them? What exactly is wrong with this picture? Shouldn't they have been concerned about how these UFOs could potentially impact future missions? Shouldn't they be more concerned about finding out who or what these things are? Well, not according to NASA's favorite spokespuppy, James Oberg. Nope. In 1982, James Oberg was trotted out to write an article that didn't provide any evidence about what the Apollo 11 astronauts reported. Well, instead, he just kind of said that the ufologists were having a great time reporting on some things that might have been created by ufologists to make the Apollo 11 mission more interesting. He semi-ended his article with, "Two questions come to mind, but cannot be answered. First, wasn't Apollo 11 exciting enough without the fictionalized UFOs? And second, if there are so many other truly authentic UFO cases on record, why do the UFO writers have to rely so heavily on such shaky evidence as this?" Note, he stated the evidence was shaky. He didn't say it wasn't true or it didn't happen, just shaky. What it all boils down to is that NASA is not only withholding important evidence of UFOs, they're covering up anything and everything they find, and they're denying it. It sounds like NASA's new motto should be, appear innocent, act concerned, and deny everything. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange Days, indeed.
I'm glad you brought that up. It was an interesting start, I think, to many exchanges of email on the UFO Updates list.
Oh,
Dave,
yeah.
Furlong.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes. It's going to be very interesting. The more that comes out of this supposedly non-classified agency is going to be very interesting.
Yeah, well, it's going to be interesting to see what comes out of that discussion. If you're listening and connected, you might go to tonight's program listing. There's a link in the news and info box in tonight's program listing, which will take you to a couple of emails, the one that Dave is referring to from today. But back in September of last year, Dave Stone posted a transcript of a portion of that program that aired in Scotland. I don't know if you're aware of this, Dave Furlott.
Oh, I certainly am. I read through that transcript. Very interesting.
Very interesting.
Yes.
The program called First on the Moon, The Untold Story was aired on the Science Channel back in September of last year. It's actually interesting what Buzz Aldrin has to say about asking NASA very subtly what it was that they were looking at, whether it was the Saturn IV-B rocket booster, by asking where it was, and it turned out it was 6,000 miles away from them.
Yeah, it's sort of like, okay, well, it's not that.
So Aldrin says in that documentary, he says, now obviously the three of us are not going to blurt out, hey Houston, we got something moving alongside of us and we don't know what it is, you know, can you tell us what it is?
Yeah.
We weren't going to do that, he said, because we know that those transmissions would be heard by all sorts of people, and who knows what somebody would have demanded, such as we turn back because of aliens or whatever the reason is, so we didn't do that.
Yeah.
But we did decide we'd just cautiously ask Houston where, how far away was the S-4B. And then there's a Dr. Baker who's quoted at the end of the transcript that Dave Stone posted to UFO Updates last September. And Dr. David Baker says there were a lot of people within the program who went off later and became convinced that UFOs existed. And that led to some concern on NASA's part, where they got the agreement of the crew never to go public and talk about these things for fear of ridicule.
Mm-hmm. Like I said, concerned about people laughing at them? I think we've got other fish to fry, guys.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, whether the public laughed at them or the people that funded laughed at them, I guess there was concern. But, I mean, why would you laugh at NASA? If NASA comes out and says, hey, our crews are seeing strange objects out here which aren't from our neighborhood, you know, who's going to laugh at NASA?
Yeah, well, not only that, but you see, that's the thing that doesn't make sense to me. They should be coming out and saying that kind of stuff, because then it's like, okay, well, maybe we should find out who these people are, or who these things are, or what these things are, and find out if they pose any kind of a threat.
Yeah, and if they can help us explore space.
Explore space further,
yes. I don't know, Dave. This world gets stranger and stranger by the moment.
No kidding.
No kidding at all. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you. And I hope that James may have been listening.
Well, yeah. Or at least listening to the podcast or the MP3 file from the archive.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's going to be interesting to see to hear what he has to say for himself in the not-too-distant future. I have a feeling that one or two people are going to call him to task.
I think so.
Yes. Good night, Dave Furlott. Thank
Good
you,
night.
Sir. We'll talk to you next week.
For sure.
Good night.
Good night.
A young man who has been in the news a lot in the United Kingdom and much discussed around the world on websites and blogs is British UFO hacker, as he is known. Gary McKinnon is his name. And I've been hoping to get to Gary to get him on the program, but yay far, we haven't managed it. A couple of people have offered to try and get him on, including one of our guests tonight, Andrew Johnson, who is a British UFO researcher. He grew up in Yorkshire, England, and graduated from Lancaster University in 1986 with a degree in computer science and physics. Andrew has mainly worked in software engineering and software development for most of the last 20 years. He's also worked full and part-time in lecturing and tutoring at a college of further education and with the Open University in the United Kingdom. He's the webmaster of checktheevidence.com, and Andrew joins us on the phone from his home, where it's a very early Sunday morning in Nottingham, England. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning, morning, Harold.
Thank you for staying up. I know you just got back off your vacation, off your holiday a few hours ago, and you kindly said that you would stay up and join us. Us being, well, Grant Cameron from Winnipeg is with us. Grant Cameron became involved in ufology back in May of 75 with personal sightings of an object which locally became known as Charlie Red Star. Those sightings were in Carmen, Manitoba, about 25 miles north of the Canada-US border, and hundreds of other people sighted the objects at the same time during a long and prolonged flap of the UFO sightings. Grant's work in the UFO field has led him to research on the late Wilbert Brockhaus Smith, who headed up the Canadian government flying saucer investigation known as Project Magnet, which ran from 1950 to 54. And during two decades, that's 20 years of work on Wilbert Brockhaus Smith, Grant was able to collect most of Smith's files and materials written. He's interviewed most of the associates around Smith who worked on the flying saucer investigation and has produced a CD-ROM data disc that holds most of the documents from the Smith files, of which I have a copy, and I thank Grant publicly for that one, on the Smith files, along with about 12 hours of audio related to Smith's work. And perhaps Grant Cameron and I will talk a little bit about that later on and how you can get yourself a copy if you so desire. Grant Cameron, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Errol. Thanks for having me on, and I'd like to say hi to Andrew, who I've corresponded with quite a bit on email. And it was actually Andrew who did all the computer work on the Smith CD. So,
well, there you go. There's a double hit for us tonight.
Yeah, he's my computer man.
Yeah.
You can hear him okay, Andrew?
Yeah, fine, yeah.
Oh, good, good, good. So let's come back to Gary McKinnon. This is a young man, not particularly a dangerous hacker, who managed to get himself into a lot of trouble with a dial-up modem and very weak security at various United States government agency networks.
Yeah, that's right. He basically started a quest, I think you might call it, for information, perhaps like all three of us, although his methods were perhaps rather different to some of ours. And that was, I think, about year 2000 that he started. And I think he was at his girlfriend's house at the time. And he describes himself as a bumbling hacker, rather than some kind of, you know, computer expert. And I think the best thing, really, you know, I can give you a bit of the details and the background,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, people might like to check out Gary's interviews with the BBC and the one with Linda Moulton Howe, because he goes through kind of, you know, most of the details, you know, that people will need to know to sort of get the background.
Mm-hmm. I have a 2.5-minute excerpt from one of the interviews that Gary McKinnon did for and with the BBC. And Grant Cameron, you also spoke to him too, didn't you? You interviewed him, or was that done by email?
No, that was done. Andrew set up the interview for me, and
mm-hmm.
I talked to him for a short period. My interview dealt a little bit more with trying to get information for Free Information Act request. It didn't get into too much of what he had discovered. It was more who had he tried to hack and who exactly, if we were going to try to make this public, and that was my intention in doing the interview, is if we're going to try him in the United States, let's put it out in the open so everybody can see exactly what kind of material he came across, and to get some exposure to the idea that people are looking for UFO information. So I was looking at who was he hacking, how did he do it, who should I file a Freedom of Information Act request with,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to the other interviews that went into what exactly did he discover.
And that interview that you had with Gary, you kindly posted to the UFO updates list, and that's available via tonight's program listing, too. If you look at tonight's listing and see the name Gary McKinnon there, if you click it, it'll take you to Grant Cameron's interview with him. I tell you what, guys, let's listen to what Gary McKinnon had to say for himself. As I said, an excerpt from a BBC interview recorded a couple of months ago.
I was using something a bit like PC Anywhere, called Remotely Anywhere, so I could actually see the desktop of the machine I had control of. And if you were walking past there, you would see the mouse move and me, you know, doing whatever I was doing on that desktop. I was in search of suppressed technology, referred to as UFO technology. I think it's the biggest kept secret in the world because of its comic value. I assumed that although it's part of a secret government project, there must be military ties. I'd read 400 expert witness testimonies, ranging from civilian air traffic controllers through military radar operators, all the way up to guys that were in charge of whether or not to launch nuclear missiles. So some very credible people. All of these people had said there are UFOs, there are aliens. One of these people was a NASA photographic expert, and she said that in Building 8 of Johnson Space Center, they regularly airbrushed out images of UFOs from the high-res satellite imagery. And using the same technique, I got down to Building 8, got a few machines there, and what she said was there was there. There was folders called filtered and unfiltered, or processed and raw, or something like that. I got one picture out of the folder, and bearing in mind, this is a 56K dial-up Dave, a 235 megabyte picture, and if you're talking 5 minutes a megabyte, obviously impossible to download. Also in a NASA proprietary image format, not a GIF or a JPEG or anything. And bear in mind, you're not downloading it, you're viewing it remotely, so in a way it is downloading because the picture's coming from there to yours, but you're not downloading it as a named file to your hard drive, you're viewing it through an application. So using the remote control program, I turned the color down to 4-bit color, and the screen resolution really, really low, and even then this picture was still, you know, juddering and coming onto the screen. But what came onto the screen was amazing. It was a culmination of all my efforts. It was a picture of something that definitely wasn't man-made. It was above the Earth's hemisphere, kind of looked like a satellite. It was cigar-shaped. It had geodesic domes above, below, to the left, to the right, and both ends of. And although it was a low-resolution picture, it was very close up. This thing was hanging in space. The Earth's hemisphere was visible below it. And no rivets, no seams, none of the stuff associated with normal man-made manufacturing. This woman had said, this is what happens in this building, in this space center. I went into that building, that space center, and saw exactly that. And I'm sitting there, bedazzled, you know, thinking, crikey, this really is looking weird and weird, the more that comes of it. I didn't think I'd be caught 3/4 of the way through of looking at the first picture I'd looked at. And also I was amazed that it was how she said it would be. So.
Yeah, so he wasn't looking to do damage, he was just looking for UFO information.
That's right, yeah. And I think what I might point out is that, you know, I've had discussions with people about Gary's case. One particular friend of mine who has, you know, no real interest in the sort of stuff that we're interested in. And Gary isn't making this story up. The technical descriptions that he gives are valid in terms of things like this remotely anywhere software. That's a real piece of software. And the way that he describes downloading the image and this sort of thing, it's all valid. And some of that is even written into the indictment that, you know, you can view if you go to the Free Gary website. So you can see some of the technical details in there. You know, so for those that are technically minded and understand the lingo, they can go and check it out and listen to what he has to say. And they will, you know, see that it's valid.
Andrew Johnson owns that voice, British UFO researcher. We're talking about Gary McKinnon, who is quite likely to be extradited to the United States to face some very, very severe penalties for hacking those easily hackable, supposedly secure United States agency networks. Yeah. What's the situation now with Gary McKinnon, the UFO hacker? He saw a portion of a picture of an object that had domes on it taken out there in space. And from what we've been hearing from Buzz Aldrin and this documentary that played in the UK and played over here in North America back in September, those guys, a lot of the astronauts saw things out there. And presumably it was those guys who took the photographs that Gary McKinnon was trying to access, yes?
I don't know who the picture was taken by that Gary saw. I think if you listen to the interview, he kind of alludes to the idea that it might have been taken by a satellite, but I don't think he explicitly says that.
No.
I don't really think he had enough time to kind of analyze the image in enough detail to decide, you know, exactly how it was taken. If you listen to the description of that particular episode, he says that the image was, he was viewing it in a low resolution color, which means that it's a bit like you view know when you, you can't see the details.
Done on an old-style photocopier or something.
Yeah.
Grant Cameron, what did you discover about Gary McKinnon and the FOIA papers? You said you had interviewed him with a particular object of perhaps finding out what you needed to get a hold of via the U.S. Freedom of Information Act.
Well, there was a couple of interesting things I came across when I was talking to Gary. One of the points I can bring up that was related just before he went to the break was Gary was sort of a low-level hacker, and I asked him when I interviewed him, I said, do you know who Matthew Bevin was? And he said, yeah, he was sort of his inspiration. That's why he did it. And Matthew Bevin was one of two hackers back in 1994. Richard Price was the other one, who also had hacked into U.S. military computers, primarily Air Force computers, also looking for UFO material. And when all was said and done with these two, they ended up just getting a slap on the wrist. The Americans dropped the whole case. It wasn't going very well in British courts. They sort of dropped it. They at one point described it as nearly starting World War III. U.S. Congress brought up the case of these two guys hacking into the computers. And so when I asked Gary whether he knew about it, he said, oh yeah, he knew. And so I think one of the important points is that when Gary was hacking, he didn't realize it was going to be as serious as it turned out to be, because he was based upon what had happened to Matthew Bevin. It was sort of like a little thing. We're going to do our investigation. We're going to look and see what we can find. And now he's facing possibly 70 years in jail and $1.5 million in fines. And the Americans have sort of really blown this thing out of proportion as to what he was really discovering. Because one of the things when I talked to him, and I wanted to clarify very specifically, what exactly did you find in terms of how long did you hack? And he said he'd hacked for 2 years. And I said, were you hacking all the time, all night? And he said, yeah, he was hacking for the vast majority of every night, all night long. And I said, and all you found was these two things. The one is this NASA photograph that he got to see part of just before, this is when he got caught.
Mm-hmm.
And the other was this sort of an Excel spreadsheet where he saw this non-terrestrial personnel being listed, non-terrestrial officers, and this ship-to-ship transfer where the names of the ships didn't match with Navy ships. And he had some idea that this may have been some extraterrestrial-type ships that were involved. But other than those two items, Gary found nothing. And this is 2 years of hacking all night long, every night. And so it sort of was what I was trying to clarify, and it seemed to match with sort of the impression I'm getting now that the American government, Canadian government, they all may be telling the truth in that they really don't know what's going on. That if you're hacking into, for example, he was hacking into Army, Navy, Air Force, NSA, different places like that, but it is possible that nothing was on those computers, that he was hacking around there, and that the material, and that is the search most researchers have been looking for the last 60 years, is where is the information? Where are the bodies buried? And he was looking for this, but it may be that the government really doesn't know that this material is held outside the government in MJ-12 or whatever scenario you want to have. And he seemed to confirm this. It's the same thing as the whole Hellyer episode, former defense minister in Canada, who basically confirmed that he basically knew nothing about what was going on, that as defense minister, and he stated right now he doesn't believe the prime minister knows, he doesn't believe that the present defense minister knows, and that there is two governments, and that the second government is where the actual information is.
Yeah, well, Gary McKinnon found a spreadsheet and an image. Were those in the NASA databases?
I'm not sure where he found the non-terrestrial officer stuff. I know the other one was in the NASA database, which would confirm that he's looking in the wrong place, because NASA would have, not very high security in terms of UFOs. I'm sure they're just basically as much in the dark as everybody else. I mean, you'd have to go to NSA or, for example, I was asking him about one of the stories that's always going around, that was back, if you remember, the documentary, 1988 documentary, UFO Cover-Up Live, where the Avery was involved and Bill Moore and stuff. And one of the things they had been stating at that point was that the Navy Intelligence was where MJ-12 was, where the actual UFO cover-up was running. Mm-hmm. So when Gary mentioned that Navy, and he said Navy investigations, and I kept trying to clarify, are you talking Navy investigations or are you talking Navy intelligence?
Yeah,
he
O-N-I,
said that's
yeah.
where the hard drive went.
Mm-hmm.
When he was arrested, the security people in the UK grabbed the hard drive and they sent it to what I think would be Navy intelligence, which has always been rumored to be the place where the top UFO material is being kept. But I made some inquiries in the United States, and somebody who I respect very highly told me the reason it probably went there is they have an expert who can recover anything off a hard drive, no matter how many times you've tried to format it or what you've tried to do with it. And that's why it went there.
Hmm.
But it was very interesting, some of the stuff that he said, but I think the stuff that he wasn't able to determine, like the fact that he was only able in 2 years to find two things, seems to confirm that possibly the material is not where we think it is.
There are a couple of points to add there. One of the things that Gary discovered was that he discovered some very large networks of computers in some of his hacking. And, for example, typically when you have a computer network, you might have, say, 50 or 100 computers on a given network.
Mm-hmm.
And he discovered a couple that had, like, over 500 machines.
There were a couple of points that you wanted to make about Gary McKinnon, the UFO hacker, before we had to break for news, and I had to interrupt you, for which I apologize. But, you know, radio runs to a schedule and waits for no one.
Sure. Yes, just a couple of things, sort of going back to a couple of points that Grant made. Firstly, the question of Gary's sentence, if you will. When he was first caught, I think it was early 2002 that he was actually caught.
Mm-hmm.
The local sort of police that were enforcing his, you know, the law which under which he was, you know, arrested. They said to him, well, you know, we've looked into the hacker cases and you'll probably get 6 months, what we call here community service, and then, you know, you might have a small fine to pay, the, maybe a few £100 or something,
mm-hmm.
and then that'll be it. But at some point during that process, they actually consulted with the US authorities, and then I think a group of them went over to the authorities in the USA and came back, and they said, oh, you know, you're in such a lot of trouble now that, you know, we don't think you're going to get this, just this community service. It's going to be something much worse. And so Gary felt that, you know, that somebody had been spoken to and, you know, certain words said, because they completely changed their attitude. And I think also it's worth mentioning quite strongly that the extradition treaty under which it's recently been ruled that he should be extradited has not been ratified by the US Congress anyway. So his treatment, again, Grant referred to Matthew Bevan previously, his treatment compared to those people has been quite a lot different. And really he doesn't truly know the reason for this. Obviously he probably has his suspicions,
mm-hmm.
but you know, and I've written to the UK Home Secretary on behalf of Gary, and you know, sort of pleaded Gary's case, and they just come back and say, well, this law was this law was agreed in 2003, and we're going to hand him over, and you know, for the British authorities to just basically hand Gary over. It's quite unusual.
Now, do you suspect, Andrew, that it's because of what he saw is why there's been such a massive knee-jerk reaction from the United States government?
Well, I believe that it is something that he has seen. I don't think it's necessarily the things that he's told us about, although it might be. I haven't spoken to Gary in detail about other things he might have seen myself. I didn't really want to sort of, go into that territory unless he was willing to discuss it openly.
Mm. Because it seems to me that Gary, in the clip that we played in that excerpt from the BBC interview, himself said that, you know, the image that he was looking at wasn't downloading it downloading to his machine.
No.
The way, if you go to a website and there are images there, it actually will stay in the cache on your machine.
Yeah.
He had to look at the image of the object, the craft, using an application that was on the machine at this, wherever the site was that he was at in at NASA.
Yeah, and some people have said, oh heck, Gary, why didn't you press the screen copy button or print screen, as it's sometimes called?
Mm-hmm.
And we've asked him that question.
Yes.
And he basically says, well, he didn't think he was going to get caught, and
he'd be able to.
he says he's not in the public eye to try and prove what he saw. He's in the public eye because he got caught.
Mm.
So I think we have to make that distinction really to. To give him a fair hearing,
Yeah. I got an email here from John Velez, who's listening down there in Ozone Park in New York. John says the guy finds a list of non-terrestrial personnel and he says he found nothing? Talk about understatement.
Yeah, I suppose. I think what he meant really was that he didn't find anything to kind of add on to that or, sort of directly corroborate it.
Mm-hmm. Grant Cameron, where do you see all of this going now?
Well, that's what sort of puzzles me is why the Americans are making such a big deal. Gary is one of 20 people that they're trying to extradite.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some bankers and there's a supposed terrorist. And it's very strange why they would make it public, because if you look at it, it looks like just a terribly, terribly weak case that you're going to drag this guy. The question is, how much are we actually going to see of this, which sort of goes to the way things are now sort of done in America, that if, for example, Errol Bruce Knapp, they sort of decide that they don't like your radio show,
mm-hmm.
and you suddenly disappear, the sad thing that I've seen is that, like in this case, the Americans, when they went to the extradition hearing in Great Britain, really didn't have to present a case. They didn't have to prove their case. This is part of the deal, that they're just able to bring them over, that the UK just hands them over. They don't have to prove anything. And the question is, what's going to happen in the United States? Like, there are some even rumors that he may end up in Guantanamo Bay.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, are they going to have an open hearing? And that's where I said the FOIA would be something. If we can get this out in the open, this is the stupidest thing. I mean, there's nothing there. Gary, even when I interviewed him, and he's mentioned this in a number of interviews, stated that when he was on there looking at this kind of stuff, he said there was people from all over the place. He said there was all sorts of people hacking in there. He wasn't the only one.
Mm.
And he could tell there was piles of other people there. So the question is, why are the Americans making such a big deal out of this, unless they can actually just keep it secret and nobody's ever going to know the extent of what happened? Because when you talk to Gary, he really didn't discover anything of any significance, according to him.
Hmm.
And so you wonder, why are they making such a big deal out of this whole thing?
And from the outset, I was wondering why they were making such a big deal out of it. Is it to make an example of a hacker?
But it's a pretty weak person to make an example. I mean, if they were going to make this public, and then it finds out that this guy basically was inept at what he was doing and really didn't find anything, it sort of looks like he failed at his mission. And so if they don't have to present any evidence, if they can just sort of put it out there, because one of the things that did happen was that he was hacking during 9/11, like he was from 2000 to 2002, so he was hacking in this period of time when things were very sensitive. So they can play that up, but if they ever have to put their evidence on the table, I think they're going to look pretty stupid.
Well, certainly, when they claim, that, what was the number of dollars of damage that was done to each computer on the network?
$5,000 worth of damage, I think he did to each.
Yeah, it had to be a charge, it had to be $5,000 worth of damage per computer, so they could multiply the charges.
Yeah.
And so it seems very, very strange why this, and it may be that in the end they're going to drop the whole thing once, because that's what happened with Matthew Bevin and this Price guy, is this dragged on for a while, and then all of a sudden they just sort of drop the charge. But
if they drop the charges, there's still the database file that talks about, what was the expression, Andrew, non-terrestrial officers?
Non-terrestrial officers, yeah.
non-terrestrial offices and the image that he saw. I keep running into people who say to me, "Hey, have you seen these images of Mars? You know, there are cities on Mars, there are collectors, people who've been collecting the images of Mars from the JPL website, and there are two versions of images. There's the original raw, which somebody discovers and hiding them in plain sight among tens of thousands of images. There's an image of what looks like a city taken from above, and then that image is replaced where it's been just washed over all of those things that look like architecture, and they have the original image with the replacement picture has the same number, and the original image has disappeared. So you put that together with the stories that Gary McKinnon, UFO hacker, was hearing about NASA airbrushing and washing out images of stuff out there in space, and your eyebrows go up way into my, well, mine do, way up into my bald area, you know. It's hello? What do you mean they're not covering anything up? Grant Cameron in Winnipeg, Manitoba is with us. He's the webmaster and producer of presidentialufo.com, the website, A Tale of Extraterrestrial Politics in the White House. In those pages, you will hopefully be led on a journey that will show you the entire known history of how the most powerful man in the world has dealt with the most highly classified secret of the last century. In short, this is the story of how the President and the White House have dealt with the mystery of UFOs. As I said earlier, hours and hours of fascinating reading at presidentialufo.com, Grant Cameron's site, and other guests for the remainder of this half hour is Andrew Johnson, whose website, checktheevidence.com, has an archive of some interesting audio and video material which just might change your ideas about some things. You never know. Go visit both of those sites in the coming week because you will learn much that perhaps you were not aware of. Gentlemen, have we covered Gary McKinnon pretty much up until this point?
Yes.
I think we've covered the main sort of points, really. I think it's just to sort of advise the listeners that it's an ongoing case. His extradition was in principle agreed on, the 21st of June. So now he's going to go to the appeal courts. So there's going to be an ongoing legal process before he actually has to, you know, be taken on a plane, presumably from the UK to the USA. And there are people actively campaigning here on Gary's behalf.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go to freegary.org.uk, you can find out all that side of things, you know, all the details of that and the history of it as well.
This is going to cost him a fortune, isn't it?
Potentially it could. I don't know what sort of level of financial support he's got, if any.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly as a person, he's currently unemployed. So he's on a low income, obviously, from that status.
Yes.
That does entitle him in this country to what's called legal aid.
Ah.
So that will allow him to, you know, offset some of his legal fees. But obviously, if he ends up with some huge fine or something terrible like that, which would really be quite outrageous, really, to be quite honest, then I don't know what he will do.
Mm. Well, I hope the folks at NASA and the NSA and ONI and whoever else he hacked have tightened up their security more than somewhat. I mean, it's mind-boggling, actually, that organizations like that, their IT people can be so stupid as to leave doors open that someone of, you know, at the lower level that Gary McKinnon is at as a hacker can get in there is, well, yeah.
And if you take a look at Matthew Bevin, if you look at what happened to Matthew Bevin when all was said and done, he ended up working for all sorts of media firms and IT security places telling them how to stop being hacked.
Mm-hmm,
if you were going to use your head, you'd say, well, this guy's got some talent at this. Let's hire this guy and help solve the problem.
Yeah, and he's obviously a very bright man in some respects. Just, you know, watching and watching him and listening to him.
Yeah.
So, you know, it would seem that he would be reasonably hireable by somebody to do exactly that.
Yeah, I mean, he's shown a great deal of persistence in getting through to where he got through. You know, I've actually done a bit of hacking myself, not really on the internet. I used to do it a lot more years ago before the days of the internet. And it's really a particular type of mentality that you have to have, you know, where you really want to crack something and, you just go at it and at it and at it, and then you'll stop and you'll think of new ideas, of how to get past the barriers. And I think that sort of mentality, when given something to do, can be a very effective tool for all types of activities.
Mm-hmm.
And there is can I add one small sad point? And this is the thing that I told Gary when I interviewed him. I said, well, I'm going to do what I can to help you, and everybody else is going to do what they can to help you, that you seem to have some support inside the UFO community. And one of the sad things that I found is that basically, when all said and done, there's really not much we can do for him. You'll see some discussion on UFO updates and people talking about it. But when it comes right down to it, if he had been hacking on behalf of Greenpeace or the gay rights movement or women's rights or something, he would have got a lot more support. The UFO community is still not really a movement. It's more of a hobby. If it was a real strong movement, we could put some pressure, open pressure to stop this. But we really don't have that much that we can really do to help this guy.
Not even financially for most of the people in the field.
Because I know when I was refused entry to the United States, I got a $100 check from Ryan Wood to help with a lawyer, and I got a bunch of Americans writing me and saying how embarrassed they were to be Americans. But other than that, the support you get is verbal support, which this guy needs an awful lot more than what we as a UFO community are able to provide him. But we'll do what we can.
Mm-hmm. Well, he certainly seems to have a lot of support elsewhere outside the UFO community, and let's hope that their pockets are more deeply lined than those of the UFO communities, and he's able to be helped that way.
Yes.
I want to thank you both gentlemen for being with us for the last hour, particularly you, Andrew, for staying up really late. And Grant, it's only 9:30 where he is, so 9:30 last night, Andrew's time. Yes. Yeah. Look forward to talking to you again, Grant Cameron, and Andrew, perhaps we can get together again in the not too distant future and find out what else it is that you're up to in your work over there in the UK.
Anytime.
Okay. Gentlemen, thank you. I look forward to talking to you both again. And on behalf of our audiences all over the world, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
Good night. Yes. Ah, Gary McKinnon, a UFO hacker. A pity he didn't get more results, and it's before he got himself busted. Well, we'll keep you updated on what happens to Gary McKinnon and what it is that the British High Courts decide. Okay, this is the time when we head off down to Alabama. The guitar of Alfred Lemberg introduces... Alfred Lemberg.
Hi there, ho there.
So you,
hi, ho there.
This, you composed this and played it as the result of sitting on your stoop early in the morning and looking at the skies and seeing strange lights dancing there. Is this the story?
Essentially accurate. What can I tell you?
Well,
guilty.
Well, hey, it's evocative. It's evocative of seeing things in the sky. Dancing lights.
And Lord knows there's plenty up there to see if you're watching.
Yes, yes, indeed. Alfred Lemberg, who is going to be a regular contributor to UFO Magazine. Congratulations, Alfred.
Yeah, Bill and Nancy Burns have been very welcoming and very warm and very impressive right off the bat, and I hate publishing people.
Mm-hmm.
They just seemed to be a horse of a different color altogether.
They're the bane of authors' lives.
Well, I mean, they've hurt a lot of people that I know personally. You know, I hesitate to mention that. Well, you know, I can tell you one. My father, you know, they stole, cheated, lied, didn't pay. You know, I don't even want to go into it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the risk of, you know, just making this the Mr. McKinnon show this evening,
mm-hmm.
I really have to bring up a couple of points that nobody else seems to be addressing, and they seem just so patently obvious to me.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that's, you know, justification.
Well, but you're Alfred Lemberg.
Oh, yes.
Oh,
of course.
Yes.
Almost famous.
No.
Anyway.
Soon to be.
What?
Soon to be famous.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we can only hope.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know, some of the things that, the points that are brought up, you know, considering that he was at it for 2 years, is a self-described and an apparently vetted inept, and he still got in.
Mm-hmm.
So it brings the point, which I think a lot of people seem reluctant to even address or bring up, but I think you have to, is that McKinnon has really got to be seen as some kind of hero, because he's uncovered what we really thought we had paid for and was state-of-the-art top drawer. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and it also occurs to me as you were saying that, Alfred Lemberg, that it's quite possible that some insiders within those agencies deliberately left the security off in the hope that somebody would come in and grab those images and database files and run with them.
You know, actually, I hadn't even thought of that myself, but that's pretty startling. That's,
isn't it, though?
You know, I mean, it's not like it hasn't happened before.
Mm-hmm. I mean, whistleblowers, but subtle, you know?
And you know, something else, another point that, you know, like, I really think needs to be hammered on is that McKinnon does appear to have some strange validity now vis-a-vis this Aldrin thing, which is completely mind-blowing and jaw-dropping, and I am stunned with incredulity.
Mm-hmm.
That's some amazing stuff.
Well, that got by most people on the UFO updates list a year ago.
Robert Morningstar.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't he writing something and talking about this like 2 years ago?
I do believe.
Yeah, it's a... well, I'll tell you, what goes around comes around, and the point is that the NASA admission that they really weren't performing their mission the way they were supposed to, and then there's this flap with what's going on with the Mars photos, and all of this, you know, again, seems to be coming to some kind of head, you know, forgetting for a moment the humiliation Britain must be feeling about the uneven extradition procedures that go on between the countries, you know?
Yes. The United States, for those of you who are wondering and who missed our discussion a little while ago, Gary McKinnon, the UFO hacker, is being extradited under terms and conditions of an extradition treaty that the United States has not signed yet.
That's another point that I was going to bring up. That stunned me. I thought this was a done deal.
Mm-hmm. Well, apparently not.
Yeah, apparently not. You know, curiouser and curiouser. But seriously, I think, you know, based on him uncovering, you know, what could only be corruption or malfeasance, or even if it's blithering incompetence, it is still unreasonably... I run out of words, actually.
Well, I'm amazed that you've actually run out of words, Alfred Lemberg.
Well, it happens even to me.
And you're not yet famous.
Not yet. Not quite yet. No. But hero, I think, what's his first name?
Who's first?
McKinnon.
Gary.
Gary McKinnon, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I really think we have to call Gary McKinnon some kind of hero here for, you know, unmasking what we really need to find out about.
Yeah, he's
properly served as American citizens in America.
Yes. He's kind of a Walter Mitty character, isn't he, Gary McKinnon?
Well, I'll tell you what, I think he's an artist and something of a poet, especially. Did you ever go over there and find those MP3s of the music that he's done?
No.
Yeah, he's...
I didn't even know that he'd done music.
I think I mentioned it on the show in passing real quickly, and you just probably just, you know, fell through the cracks.
Yeah.
But, yeah, he's a musician, and, well, let me just say that he doesn't suck. All right? No. I mean, actually, the guy is kind of wonderful and kind of poetic and kind of ethereal and startling and, you know, good music. I enjoy listening to it.
Okay. And how do we get to that? Do you recall, or are you going to have
I'll search it out for you. And,
all right.
Just came up in conversation. I'll search it out for you, and I'll get you the URL.
And then over the remainder of the weekend, I'll put it up into the news and info box at tonight's program listing. How's that?
Yeah, that would be, you know, people, you should go over there and listen to this guy. He is not without talent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the whole astronaut thing, I mean, we've been hearing whispers about what they possibly might have seen but won't fess up to for years and years and years now. And suddenly, you know, the Scottish newspaper picks up on a documentary that ran in the UK, that ran in North America, well, certainly in the United States back in early September of last year. I get the feeling that this is going to snowball more than somewhat in the next little while.
Well, I was kind of wondering if, you know, you had mentioned, you and Dave were talking, that it just may be that before I get into that, I really have to mention something else. I'm sorry. Because, you know, I think it's workable and fortuitous that everybody send, as you already have, but everybody send Richard Hall a little positive energy and a little a thought, a good feeling, and to push him through this thing, because we really need him out the other side.
Oh, we certainly do, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. If you go to HallRichard.com, or if you can't remember that, look at the program listings, and you'll see the Journal of UFO History and Alfred Lemberg's picture there. There are all kinds of ways of getting in touch with Richard Hall, and send him some good wishes and send him some energy, because he's going to need it over the next week, because, as Alfred says, we need him around.
A couple more years anyway. 18 months. 18
months. Oh, don't put a limit on it, Alfred.
I don't want to appear greedy.
Julian says to me in my ear, do I need to dump what he just said? Alfred Lemberg is with us, a regular biweekly contributor to this program from down there in Alabama. We lost, and I wasn't here last week. Spent nine lovely, lovely 24-hour periods up at the cottage on Go Home Lake, where there was a sighting a few years ago, actually. And missed telling you that last Saturday that a well-known name in the field, the man who put together the UFO cat, the UFO catalog, Dr. Willie Smith, passed away down there in Florida. And Willie had put in many, many, many years in the field. And he has moved on from this part of life where we know absolutely nothing about anything that this program covers, to perhaps knowing what it's all about beyond the pale, beyond the across the great divide, I guess is the expression. And I'm sure there are many UFO researchers who have moved on, who perhaps have found out what it's all about. Their life's work has been answered, perhaps. If you believe in the afterlife and in reincarnation, who knows what it is that you discover about what it was that you wanted to know in your immediately prior life. Does that feel better, Alfred?
Oh, yes, I'm quite clear now.
Good, yes, yes, you.
In the first place, let me say briefly that I apologize for the insensitivity of my remark. I was just trying for a little gallows humor that I'm sure that Mr. Hall will appreciate.
Oh, of course he will. Dick has a sense of humor.
I think he does.
Yes, he does. About many things, but not about what you just said. Ah, dear. We're having too much fun here, and our one listener will get offended if we laugh and have a good time than, you know, just being clubby and boys clubby and excluding them.
I suppose.
Yes. And you have no idea what I'm talking about, and frankly, neither do I.
You know, before we started talking about Richard Hall,
yes.
I was wondering that vis-a-vis all of these pretty startling, exciting, astonishing things that are going on vis-a-vis NASA not doing its job, astronaut UFO sightings, that other thing you mentioned about the Mars photos,
mm-hmm.
is that you and Dave had been talking about... Well, basically, that there will be discussion of the Heflin. That's what I'm trying to say. There'll be discussion of the Heflin photos much longer and at much greater intensity than people will be addressing the astronauts not coming clean.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my prediction, and I think I can articulate why. I mean, the fact is that
maybe you
start going off in that direction, and you know, it just gets too big for the program. But I think people know where I'm going with that.
Well, those of them that understand what the Heflin pictures photographs are, the pictures that were taken many years ago now by a man named Rex Heflin. And as is always the case on the UFO Updates email list that I have the pleasure of moderating, people would much sooner discuss old cases. Nothing wrong with that, but rather than get into some of the new anomalies or the newer anomalies that are popping up on a constant basis. For instance, the astronauts seeing UFOs.
And if the British ufologist John Rimmer and I can agree that it needs to stop, maybe it should be brought to something of a judicious close, because I think it's been hacked to death.
Yes.
Well, I mean, that's
it's probably one of the longest running threads ever in the 10, 12 years of existence of UFO Updates.
Well, perhaps, you know, I've been watching it pretty close, and I've seen things go on, and this has really gone on and on to the point of the measurements of old wooden poles and discussions if it's not still there at the site, and maybe they've got, you know, some kind of residue on them, and it's just craziness, you know. God.
Yeah, and we're going on and on about it now, aren't we?
Well, you know, I mean, it's, yes.
Yes, so we have about 4 minutes left, Alfred. Do you have notes of other things that you'd like to cover tonight, or should we just quit now?
Well, do you remember? Do you remember the? It was some video that we were seeing it a couple of years back, and you probably saw it up in Canada too, of this little sphere UFO thing that roars up into the field of view of the camera, obviously taken from the shuttle, and then another shot of it cruising quickly with jerky movements around the antennas around the space station.
Yeah, I remember that, yes.
Yes, and it's quickly written off as that's just something that we built to, use to inspect, cut, wait a minute, we've never heard about that before since. You know what I'm saying? And the point is that something that mechanical and that much of an object roaring and zipping and pirouetting around those antenna arrays like it was doing, that's just not something I think that we would be able to control, number one, mm-hmm. nor would we want to if we could.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. there is much going on down here and up there that we're not privy to.
To be privy. You know, I'm tired of hearing that. I've been there, done that, shouted till I'm blue in the face. The fact is, I think we need to start coming clean with some details there, boys. You know, we can't put off this visit to the dentist office forever.
Lord knows, I have been trying. I don't understand. I don't understand the value of covering up something as astounding as apparently the astronauts have come across. Where we don't want you to talk about it because, you know, they might call us crazy. I mean, what kind of thinking is that?
Well, that was crazy. That
NASA set up for space exploration discovers something out there that is absolutely mind-blowing.
Yeah, when Dave Pralott was talking about the shaky evidence. Wait a minute. Shaky? You mean not bogus, not untrue, not a lie, not a hoax? Shaky? Wait, God, let's go back to that.
Yeah. There is no evidence.
And withholding the evidence that is there.
There is no evidence. Right. Yeah. You have to wonder, yeah. Public servants.
I gotta tell you this too.
Yes.
The thing, you know, we have the astronauts not coming clean, NASA not coming clean. Okay, that's more or less kind of admitted now. Oh, wait a minute. There was some speculation a couple of weeks ago now about SETI not coming clean. You know, I wonder if there might not be some kind of hookup and that maybe SETI has heard couple of signals.
Maybe Stephen Greer, and I shouldn't have laughed at him quite as hard as I did the last time he was on when Stuart Miller told us Stephen Greer had come out and said that SETI had actually made three contacts. If you've made the contacts, then there's no point in looking any further, so let's shut the project down. No, it's like discovering the cure for cancer. You know, rumor has it that they're not going to, you know, the number of people that would go out of business if SETI were closed down.
And if we have a few seconds here at the end, I would like to thank Grant Cameron for talking about W.B. Smith and lending him some validity and integrity and discipline and the fact that he was informed and the fact that he was experienced and he was right there. Thank you, Mr. Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Lemberg. We shall talk to you again in 2 weeks, Alfred.
I'll be doing my next.
Yes, alienview.net. Alienview.net, Alfred Lemberg's website. Go take yourselves a look. We'll talk to you next week. Wayne St. John will be here, and maybe even David Cherniak on his road trip. Good night.
That's this week's edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mastardelli. Send any questions or comments to sdi@virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Six Productions. Join us again next Saturday.